session number 21296, rule 2.
Alan Turturilto.
I thought it was quite a good show and I didn't report him. Interestingly enough, when we did the Alla crossing, which we did some months later, the Germans had left a bridge intact, but it had holes in. And one of our chaps fell down through a hole, landed on a sandbank in the middle of the river, in a sitting position, and had his mess tin in a pocket we all had in the bottom of our parachute smocks. But he caught me up a couple of days later, still had his weapons, a black and blue backside, and a squashed mess tin. But I thought that was a very good show too.
So you're preparing to go to Holland?
Yes, and we did eventually go on the Ben McCree, landed at Ostend, went to a big transit camp, which we shared with Americans, who were quite good chaps, and we had a very amusing incident on night one. We're all eating our meal. I suppose there must have been 200 or 300 people sitting down in this great room. And an American officer stood up. They were slightly ahead with us of their meal. They'd finished their meal, effectively. And he said, gentlemen, we are in an English officer's mess, and you don't smoke in an English officer's mess. So all the Americans put their fags out, and of course my chaps had to put their fags out as well. Anyway, we then got on a train, and we went up, bloody cold, very cold, freezing cold train, unheated. In the middle of the night, it stopped, and mysteriously, there were people there with food. I suppose these things are organised by somebody. And then we got out and took transport to a place called Barlou on the Maas. We took over from a light infantry regiment, had a little house, and forward of the house, there was the river, about 1 mile distant. And on the riverbank there was a slit trench. And I was told it was my contribution to the war effort to go down to the slit trench every night when it got dark and sit in the trench with a telephone. And if any activity occurred, I was to turn the handle of the telephone and report that activity. I discovered it was very, very cold, very cold. And I liberated a sack, made myself a pixie hood, and I used to sit at the bottom of this trench with my pixie hood on while the snow gently gathered on top of it. And one night, just for fun, there was quite a bit of noise going on from the other side. I rang up and said, I think there's something happening on the other side. I think, honestly, it was a party. And immediately I heard the sound of guns way behind me and avalanches of shells came over. The party stopped, and I suppose that was the first time I had any influence whatsoever on the conduct of the war in north of Europe. It wasn't very profound, but at least I got some guns fired.
We haven't said which unit you were in, I don't think.
No, I was with 45 Commando, Royal Marines, and I had joined them at Bexhill prior to going over. Of course, quite a lot of people in the unit had been in Normandy, and that was somewhat of an embarrassment, I have to say. I had, at that time, I had 9 men under command, and they'd all been in Normandy, so they knew a lot more about what was going on than I did. But that's life.
Which company and platoon were you in?
At that time, I was in E for Easy Troop. It was there were A, B, C, D, E, F, yes. There were 5 troops in the commando, and young officers were normally put in E Troop, because the leader of that troop, Captain Beadle, later Major Beadle, had lots of experience, and he was reckoned to be a good tutor. So you learnt a lot serving with Ian Beadle, if you didn't get killed, which was quite likely. He was always in the forefront of everything.
And you were in a platoon as well?
Well, a troop was divided into 4 sections, with a sergeant in charge of each section. But I have to say that as the war went on, the numbers, of course, fluctuated. People got killed, reinforcements came, and we were never up to full strength. We lost, in fact, 111 dead out of 500. So if you say two people wounded for every one that was killed, a fair proportion fell by the wayside. Some, of course, did more than their share and got wounded twice.
So you've just arrived on these positions on the Mars. What happened next?
Not much. I sat with my telephone. Nothing happened. And then we were moved up to Echt. And Echt had just been the scene of quite fierce fighting. And I was given a room in the priest's house. It only had three walls, which was a disadvantage. And we were all told that the next morning we would move forward, presumably to meet the filthy Hun. And sure enough, the next morning we were all roused at some god-awful hour, stood in the street and had our breakfast, cold soya links, which is what it always was. And to anybody who's not familiar with soya links, you get a large tin, take the top off and tip out the contents, which is rather like solidified dog food, and it's divided into segments. Nobody even pretended it was meat, it was soya links. So we got that.
And what did it taste like?
Bloody awful. I think if you're hungry, of course, perhaps it doesn't matter very much. And the other thing was, I'd been aware of the war and rationing and all that since I was 14. And I accepted that. We got soya links for breakfast. You know, if anybody had queried it with me, I'd have probably said, what do you expect, bacon and eggs? I mean, that's what we got for breakfast. That's what we got for breakfast. Nobody queried it. Nobody ever said, I don't like this, take it away. They just, you'd eat it. So we did that. And then we marched up the road to Masbracht. And that was one of life's great experiences. It was cold. It was cold enough to freeze the oil in automatic weapons. It was that cold. The sky was a clear blue. We were going forward. There wasn't any opposition. And great big American bombers were flying over in squadrons, trailing their vapor trails. And, you know, I felt quite patriotic. We got to Masbracht, then into the village of Brachtebeek, and then we started to get shelled. And that's when it started. That was the 23rd of January, 1945. The object of the whole exercise was to take a town called Linne. And Brachtebeek, the main road runs roughly north-south. And there were two routes to the town of Linne, about 3 miles distant, and they were at right angles to the road we were on. One was a tarmac road, which led past the station, and the other one was across fields. We were divided into two parties, and I was in the across fields lot. The others went down the road. We had to cross, both parties had to cross a stream called the Montfortebeek, which was strongly defended. Germans were very good at retreating. I mean, they fell back, leaving a few snipers about. They fell back, consolidated on a defensive line, which, of course, the advancing forces ran into. And they defended the line very heavily, and the party on the main road, which was not my party, ran into tremendous fire, failed to get forward. Their medical man got a VC, by the way, that's Corporal Harden, and some of them were trapped overnight in the station buildings, which are very small. My little party went forward, and halfway to the beak, I was walking alongside a corporal called Cox. We're strolling forward, sun was shining. There was a single shot, and I think he was dead when he hit the ground. Very distinguished looking person. And I began to realize the advantages of looking very undistinguished, which I always did. He was tall, wearing the same as I was wearing, carrying a Thompson submachine gun. We then went forward, there was no more firing, and when we got to the stream, we came under heavy fire, and I was told to lie on the ice, facing left to my axis of advance, in case we were outflanked. So I lay there on the ice, got bombarded with mortars the whole afternoon, had several casualties, including one chap I remember. He was hit by shrapnel, lots of blood, and by that time a tank had come up behind us and they were evacuating wounded. And I said, can you manage to crawl over there? And he said, yes, he thought so, and took off like he was doing the 3-minute mile. And I learnt another important lesson that afternoon. People who've got lots of blood all over them aren't necessarily badly hurt, whereas people who are unmarked, very often dead. Anyway, we stayed there. I felt I wasn't doing much good. Meantime, the main body of my party went forward and assaulted the beak, the Mondehort beak, got over, were counterattacked, stayed where they were. And when it got dark, we followed up. En route, by the way, I was asked by our medical man if I would assign somebody to go with him to bring in a wounded German. So I said, no, but I'll come with you myself. So I did that. And this German was not wounded in the sense that he was bleeding. He was rigid, absolutely rigid, with fear or something. Anyway, we picked him up. I remember I took his head. The other chap took his feet, and we slung him on top of a jeep. We then went on and came to a German zigzag trench which had been captured, and I spent the night there. And during the night, a man with a sack came along, throwing tins into the trench. I got peaches. I felt pretty hurt about that. And last week I took my grandchildren to see the same trench. So we all sat in it. It's still there. It's on a little hill, surrounded by trees, never been ploughed or turned over or anything like that. So if you want to see a German zigzag trench, there's one beside the Montfort Peak near Linne. Still there. It's only about 18 inches deep now. Anyway, we went on. Having spent the night there, the next morning went down to a very beautiful house on the banks of the Maas. I think I was there a couple of days. And then we did a night raid across the Maas on a feature which we call Belle Isle, because we happened to do the raid on the anniversary of the capture of Belle Isle by the Marines in whatever year it was. The feature was formed by the Maas, which makes a huge loop in that area, almost joining up to itself. And then there's a canal with locks across the narrow end of the loop. So effectively it is an island, about a mile and a half across and 3 miles long. And the Maas was running at about 6 or 7 knots. It was in flood, there was snow everywhere. And it really was not a very good night. And the party was divided into two sub-parties. One group were about 60 under command of a major, with a captain and a lieutenant. And then there was a party had to guard the boats, and that was my 9 men and me. We all crossed on canvas boats, and the main raiding party, when they hit the bank, turned left to go down to the lock to shoot up a German defended position. In my opinion, they acted in a very amateur fashion, which isn't surprising because none of the three officers had been under fire before. Two of them had distinguished war records in the Royal Marines, but in big ships, and they were probably splendid soldiers, but they seemed to me to make far too much noise, and they got down to the German position, were completely, they weren't annihilated in the sense that every person was killed, but the three officers were all captured or killed. A high proportion of the Marines were wounded and captured, and I was back at the beachhead with my boats, where there happened to be a little engine shed with a jolly little engine, just like a little red engine, only it was black, used for hauling gravel. And there was an inspection pit, two inspection pits inside the shed, so I positioned my chaps, four of them in the inspection pits and the others in the snow round about, because they all had white suits. And the first we knew of the outcome of the attack on the Germans, there were, by the way, 50 of them, was when people began to stream back, some of them wounded, and getting in the boats and going to the home bank and giving us good advice, such as you'd better run away. However, that didn't seem a good idea. And my chaps stayed where they were, and I went down to see the last group. I thought it would be the last group of the main party into the boats, and when they'd gone, I walked up the bank, up the embankment. As I came over the top, there were 20 Germans standing in a line facing me about 30 feet away. You could see this quite clearly. It was bright moonlight. You could have read certainly the headlines of a newspaper. And one of these Germans stood forward and said, "You must surrender," which I thought was a very fair offer. And then he said again, "You must surrender." Meantime, my chaps were all keeping nice and quiet, and I said, sotto voce, "Are you all ready?" And somebody said, "Yes." So I said, "On my command," and opened fire. We all opened fire at once. Bren gun, 3 Thompson submachine guns, and the rest were rifles. And we killed, let's see now, we killed 8, wounded 8, and 2 got away. That doesn't add up to 20, does it? But there were just 2 got away, and the others were killed and wounded. Later on, then we heard noises from the home bank telling us to come back. So we went down, got in the last remaining boat, pushed off, and then the voice from the home bank said, "You've left somebody." So I knew we hadn't, but there was actually a wounded man. So we went back, and the Bren gunner and I went up the bank and fired in the general direction of Berlin, and we got this chap on the boat. He'd been shot in the backside, the bullet exiting on the inside of his thigh. I met him later. He said if it had been 2 inches further over, I wouldn't have had a family, but he did have a family. And we got him off and we came back. I discovered, by the way, that the boat had a tendency to go around in circles. It's funny how useless information suddenly comes back to you. When I'd been at university, I was a cox in the rowing crew. So I said, "Can anybody steer this damn thing?" So somebody volunteered. And I started shouting, in, out, in the proper fashion. And we came home very well. Then went back to the house, where I found they were using my bedroom as a surgery, which wasn't too good. And somebody gave me a mug of something, and it was champagne. So I learned something else of great importance that night. Champagne is really very nice. Never get enough of it. But that was the first night I had it. And that was the completely, as it turned out, a completely ineffective raid. But it could have, and we just didn't know. It had been intended to go across the island and shoot up a place called Merrim, where the Germans were. But that was abandoned. Anyway, we got most of the chaps back, and that was the end of that. And we had a few days rest after that. And then we went into the town of Linné, where I had a particularly fine house right beside the church, with a forward slope towards the German positions. And they had got a Nebelwerfer in position, 8-barrel mortar, which they used to fire at us from time to time. One day, a large furniture van painted blue came along the road at the foot of our forward slope, turned, came up the driveway, and parked in front of my house. The sides dropped down. A loudspeaker on the roof started blaring out pop music, and the American ladies inside inquired whether we could use a donut. I said, "Probably, but you do realise there's nobody in front of you except Germans." And they said, "Oh, honey, we'll just be a minute." So they served coffee and donuts and then folded up the sides of their truck and off they went. I must say, 10 out of 10 for initiative. Anyway, we then left that location and went up to Venray to try out some new equipment and have a rest before the Rhine crossing. In the trying out of equipment, we got some Buffaloes, which, as you'll know, they really like tanks without a top on, but the tracks have sort of cups on them, So when the tracks rotate, if you're lucky, if you're in water, the thing goes forward. So we all went off to a canal, which had 45 degree banks covered with stone. And all the chaps with red tabs and so on all stood around. And there were only about six of these vehicles. We all got in, it went down the slope one side into the water, across the canal, hit the other bank, the tracks went round and round and round, but the vehicles wouldn't go up the slope, too steep. So eventually, ignominiously, we went off about a mile downstream where we could get out. And I thought, after Dieppe, you would have thought, somebody would have worked out that these vehicles couldn't go up a bank 45 degrees stone. And indeed on the Rhine crossing itself, we landed at a place called Grafinsel, which was almost dead flat. But it didn't seem to me you needed to be brain of Britain to work out they wouldn't go up a 45 degree slope. Anyway, we all had a good afternoon and supper was eventually served. And we went straight from Venray to a position on the Rhine quite close to Genap, where a big bridge had been built. It was a floating bridge, and the Canadian army were locked in the battle at Afferden, Goff and Calcar. These, as you know, being towns which were actually part of the Siegfried Line. And I crossed with the other chaps. One evening, we picked... Oh, before we went, somebody put an artillery battery behind the house I was in on the banks of the Maas. And every time they fired, slates fell off. I tell you this only because Ian Beadle, whom I mentioned earlier, was my troop commander at that time. And he went to sleep in an upright chair, sitting down in an upright chair. And before he went to sleep, he said, if a dispatch rider should come with a message, I had to wake him up and tell him. Sure enough, a dispatch rider did come. I woke him up and said, "You awake, Ian?" "Yes." "Sure, yes." Gave him the message. The next morning, still sitting in his upright chair, he denied that he'd ever had the message. He did eventually accept that. I only mention it because people did get very tired. I came to the conclusion that 48 hours was about the limit. I could be wrong about that, but I came to the view that after 48 hours, people didn't know what they were doing. Anyway, with that in mind, the next morning, bright and early, some Americans came with an open trucks, and we all got American rations for the day, which was a great disappointment to one and all, because they didn't like them. And we went across the Genap Bridge, and we went to Afferden. And when we got there, we went onto a low rise in the ground, along the top of which were something like 50 Bofors guns. There were numerous trucks bringing up ammunition for these guns. As you know, they fire clips of five shells. And beyond the rise was the town of Afferden. And they were firing horizontally, flat trajectory, continuously. And the town was just disintegrating street by street. Oh, terrible. Terrible for the inhabitants. And we then received the good news that at night we were to go southwards, parallel with the Rhine, through a heavily wooded area, when it was thought that the Germans were withdrawing. So that's good news. But it was very heavily mined, which is terrible news. I suppose we all have our pet hates. I also was very frightened of mines, because you can't see them. Anyway, off we went, and we went in a single file, as we always did, with the leading section spreading, laying out the white tape. It's about 2 inches thick. So some lucky volunteer would have a harness attached to his back with this white tape. And of course, the bobbin used to squeak like mad, so we used to pee on it as a means of lubrication. And it was my section that was chosen. and we had to stop at every crossing of a path or anything with our bayonets and poke about looking for mines, feeling for wires and all the rest of it. And we went 7 miles. No Germans, they'd all gone home. And we arrived at the town of Well, W-E-L-L, on the banks of the Rhine, to find two things. Firstly, we found a nunnery which had been evacuated, and we also found that 46 Commando was still on what I call the home side of the river. I keep saying the Rhine, this was the Maas. They were on the home side of the Maas, and we yoo-hooed to them, and they yoo-hooed to us, and they sent us breakfast over. And they also sent many boxes of goodies. So we lit a fire under the boiler in the building and had a sort of continuous hot meal, which went on for about 4 days. And it took the army that long to get through to us because there were felled trees, booby traps and all sorts of things. It was lovely. It was nice and peaceful. The bit that wasn't so lovely is they had quite a number of casualties blowing up mines. And from there we went to the banks of the Rhine, and we crossed the Rhine mid great excitement in whatever date it was in April.
Was the Rhine crossing easy for you?
Was easy as it was noisy, but we didn't lose many dead or anything like that. First of all, we were in a little house, which was nice, covered with smoke, because Mr. Montgomery had decided we should all live in a smoke screen. And then on the given night, the brigade was at full strength. That's 46 Commando, 45, 3 and 6 Army. And we would cross by two means, either in the buffaloes or in plywood storm boats with a big outboard engine. And I remember thinking to myself, well, if I go in a buffalo, I'll have armoured protection. If I go in a storm boat, I'll get there quicker. And I didn't really know which I preferred. But we weren't given a choice, of course. We went to a huge flat marshalling area in a meadow on the east bank of the Rhine. And the engineers had placed petrol tins, or some sort of tins, in rows. Each tin had a candle inside it, and each tin had, on the eastern side of that tin, a triangle, a circular hole, or a cross, or a square. And we were told to follow one of those. I forget which one, but supposing we had to follow the triangle, we arrived at this place at black dark and marched in lines down the tins and then lay on the ground. At about tea time, 250 Lancasters came over and unloaded on Wesel. And then at night, about the same number of medium bombers came over and unloaded on Wesel. And the artillery barrage, I'm told, contained 2,000 or 3,000 guns. I well believe it. There was heavy stuff firing from the back, including Americans. Their artillery was very good. And then 25-pounders, a bit closer, and 3-inch mortars, and rocket-firing vehicles launching rockets. So what with one thing and another, the ground was actually shaking. I remember somebody saying, I hope the artillery barrage has done its work. And I remembered reading about Monte Cassino, where the bombers reduced the monastery to rubble and the Germans turned the rubble into a fort. I'm very, very sceptical about heavy bombing in close support of infantry. I'm equally enthusiastic about close support from rocket-firing fighters or dive bombers. That can be very effective. But heavy bombing, you kill a lot of civilians, wreck the town, and then it takes the engineers days to clear a road up from the bridge. But no doubt it'd make the boys in blue feel good. Anyway, as we were crossing, the water was going up and down. We landed. We're in a buffalo. I remember standing on the front of this buffalo and shouting rude words to everybody. I was just getting excited, I guess, and jumped off. Oh, I didn't lose anybody. and we made our way towards the town following the white tape. And when we got to the outskirts of the town, it was a mass of rubble. And the first thing that happened, some Germans appeared from the rubble, fired a couple of Panzerfausts at our leading party, and blew up our colonel. I was sorry about that. He wasn't badly hurt, though. But absolutely typical. You bomb a town, and you assume the soldiers will all be dead. Of course, they're very seldom dead.